That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy, here to do one thing and one thing only, and that is to make you better with your money. It is the promise that I start every single show with, and I'm fairly certain that I have yet to break that promise. So stick around for the next hour or so if you are someone that has never got an education in the world of finance and thinks that it might be something quite important to get at this stage of your life. I'm assuming, just a guess, that it's most of you, seeing as there is pretty much zero financial education, or formal financial education, should I say, in this country. So, That Money Show, what do we do here? What's the point of sticking around? Well, we're going to do a whole bunch of stuff on the topic of money. We like to kick off every single week with the discussion around the economy, the news, what's actually going on that you should be aware of. I bring you up to speed. You do not need to scroll every news website, read every newspaper, because I bring you the relevant stuff that affects the money in your pocket. And then, of course, we like to bring in the coolest, most interesting range of experts, famous faces, guests to share their own personal finance advice and experiences. And coming up this week, I've got Norma Cassius from At Think Like a Bank. She is a money management consultant, counselor, and psychotherapist to talk about the red flags that could lead to financial manipulation in relationships. I mean, one of my favorite questions is, should you be paying, or who should pay on a first date? So I'm very interested to throw that one at Norma and get her reply. I'm assuming the conversation might go a little bit deeper than that, but it's a nice surface level one to break it. And then I'll share my idea on what I think the answer should be as well. If you are watching live, do let us know. What do you think? Who should pay on the first date? We'll come up with that a little bit later. But of course, let's kick off with the news. What is going on right now in the economy that's going to affect the money in your back pocket? And yet again, the story on the front of most newspapers is all about employers and what is going to happen come April this year when a bunch of new regulations and taxes come into play thanks to Mrs. Rachel Reeves and the Labour government. I'm not saying that like aggressively or anything like that. It's just a factual thing. Changes are on their way. And the story this week is in bold letters, firms plan job cuts as employment costs rise. So should I do like a 60-second bring you up to speed of what these changes are? And then we can take a look at how companies are responding to these changes. In other words, firms plan job cuts. That is their response, or there are a number of firms that we'll get into in just a second. But to bring you up to speed, there are going to be two, let's say, major changes come this April that are massively affecting how companies are having to think. Number one is national insurance. Now, to most people, they think that national insurance is just another tax that you pay next to your income tax. For you, it comes out of your paycheck. It's not nowhere near as much as income tax, but it's just another tax. Well, if you didn't know, your employer also has to pay national insurance for every single employee in the business. And the reason why it's going up so much for them is it's going up from just over, or just under 14%, should I say, to 15%. But not just that, the amount that they have to start paying it from drops down to £5,000. So they don't pay on the first £5,000 of the salary they give someone, but they start paying it on everything above that. This is going to cause huge increases in costs to businesses, especially those in the hospitality and leisures industry, as well as retail industries that have a large number of staff. We're talking about probably around £1,000 per employee on the average salary. Not just that, but national minimum wage is also going up. Now, don't get me wrong, like, I do believe that national minimum wage does have to go up every single year. We have inflation, therefore wages need to rise in line with inflation. If the national minimum wage stayed as it was, people would literally not be able to afford to live. That's why some people call it the national living cost, some people call it national minimum wage. Whatever you want to call it, it does need to go up every single year. This year it's going up quite significantly, but we've had significant raises in inflation over the past few years, so that makes sense. But it's just another burden on companies that probably employ quite a large amount of staff at national minimum wage. Again, I'm pointing towards hospitality and retail as the most obvious sectors for that. So companies have to respond to this, and we've spoken a lot about the increase in prices projected, but now it's starting to look about companies planning to cut jobs or recruit fewer people because of these changes. So there was a study done by CIPD. They are the Chartered Institute of Personal and Development, who have said that the businesses they've questioned have said they're both going to cut jobs, hire a few people, and raise prices to cover these increasing employment costs. Another study by the Federation of Small Businesses has found that in the final 3 months of last year, so the last quarter of last year, business confidence amongst small firms hit its lowest point for 10 years, not including the COVID pandemic. Of course, during COVID, small businesses pretty much had to shut up shop. So to say it's the lowest in 10 years is a very significant finding. The Treasury, so that is Rachel Reeves and the sector of the government that she controls, have said that they are trying to do is deliver stability to businesses, that they need to invest and to grow. But of course, this isn't coming across from the businesses themselves. So there was a study, like I said, the CIPD study, that just over a third of the 2,000 firms it spoke to said that they plan to reduce their headcount through redundancies or by recruiting fewer workers. Not ideal, really not good. But again, the government's big picture here is to grow the economy. So they still believe that even though these are going to be kind of the hard consequences of what they're doing, they're going to grow the economy nonetheless, which is a good thing. However, recent results haven't exactly shown that. Okay, the latest growth results, I think, for Rachel Reeves was a growth of 0.1% when the expectation was that it was going to be negative. But 0.1% is still very close to negative growth. Now, remember, two quarters, back-to-back quarters of negative growth is a recession. Recession normally leads to high unemployment. Plus, a lot of companies not looking to hire new people or get rid of a lot of people, employment being pushed up even more. This could look to be another recession on its way. I'm just stating factual things here. These aren't predictions from me, but these are things that everyone needs to have their eyes looking out for. So, if you are a company, we would love to hear from you. What are the things that you are going to be doing? You can DM us at That Money Show if you want to come and share your thoughts on how your business needs to restructure come April, or what you're already doing to change and restructure it at the moment. And if you're an employee that might have had their job cut or is struggling to find work at the moment, especially in hospitality or retail, let us know what's going on. What is the state of the industry right now? Is it absolutely impossible to get a job? Because I would not be surprised if the answer is yes. So this is what's going on. It's good to be aware of it, just so you understand the current state of the economy. Now, what else is going on in the news? Do I have some good news for you? Well, this title was Chill of Inflation Threatens Britain Again After Europe's Long, Hard Winter. I do have to say, by the way, that 9 times out of 10, a news story when it comes to finance is not positive in this country. I feel like we just love the cup to be half empty. Let me think. I'm trying to think off the cuff of some good financial news that I could give you. But we'll dive into this inflation story because it does end with a little bit of good news. So hang around to the end of this story. So over the past 3 months, we have had inflation of, well, over the past, I suppose, quarter, let's say. It was 1.7% last September, 2.5% in December, 2.8% in January. And the Bank of England are guessing that inflation is going to keep rising towards 3.7% this year. But another study has come out to this, guess that it's going to be around 3.2%. This is above the Bank of England's desire to try and keep it at 2%. That is the level the Bank of England want inflation to be at, 2%. So 3.7% is almost double what the Bank of England want it to be. In other words, not good news. However, the Bank of England are still coming out with this, I suppose, policy of everything's okay, this is all expected, it's not shooting up or anything like that. And they do still believe that the return of inflation to come down is going to be absolutely fine. Inflation going up like this, not ideal. Over the past 18 months, we've actually gone through a relatively stable period where wage rises have outpaced or outgrown inflation. So when wages grow more than inflation, the economy or the entire, you know, UK as a whole gets richer because we're growing it quicker than the value of things are going on, which is good. But higher inflation means that inflation is going to pick up against wages as well. And so therefore, we might not have an economy that grows. So this is just something to be aware of. But I did promise you some good news. So what was that good news? Well, Mr. Trump, anyone heard of him? He's actually come up in a few shows over the past few weeks. I feel like maybe we'll try and get him on for next week. Donald, if you're listening, I know you're a big listener of That Money Show. Feel free to drop us a DM or just text me. You've got my number. And we'll come and we'll have a chat to you about some tariffs maybe or something like that. But the reason why there's some I suppose, relatively good-ish news around him is that he has very strong threats right now, or a very strong intention to end the Ukraine war. Now, the ending of the Ukraine war, or the start of the Ukraine war, let's actually go back that way, was actually kind of the cause of a huge spike in inflation as energy prices shot up, because that region of the world, Russia, we know, is one of the biggest energy providers in the world. A war, lots of tariffs going on, Russia, energy prices shoot up. Energy are a huge contributor to the actual rate of inflation. Now, if the war is eventually ended, this could result in a flood of cheaper energy into the market, A, reducing the price at your petrol station, hopefully some good news to you, but overall reducing this threat of inflation over the summer. Now, Trump has also said that he could use the threat of flooding the market with cheap US gas and oil if Putin refuses to make concessions. So we've kind of got these two ideas, that if the war does end and Putin plays ball, then there could be a flood of cheap energy, and the vice versa. If he doesn't play ball, Trump might use that to then flood the market with cheap energy. Either way, it might be a reduction in inflation. So potential light at the end of the tunnel, I'm not so sure. Maybe inflation kind of going up right now, but it's kind of a bit in turmoil, you know, around the summer. Let's hope it comes back down to that 2%. Like I said, no one's panicking right now. And in fact, even with inflation going up, the Bank of England in their last meeting did increase the interest rate. Normally, when inflation is super high, the Bank of England likes to keep interest rates super high as well, because that's kind of their only tool to reduce inflation. This time they actually have reduced the interest rates, even though inflation is on the up, meaning that they can't be too worried about that, or they've got bigger fish to fry. Which one of those questions is the right one? You'll have to tell me. And anything else going on? So Thames Water, I hope a lot of you know that, they're pretty much one of the biggest water or utility companies in the entire country, have launched an appeal to increase the amount that that bills are going to be in a couple of years. So what's the story here? Well, currently, Ofwat, you might have heard of Ofgem or Off, there's probably another one, Ofsted, there we go, see, I know some other offs in my head. They are the current industry regulators, and they cap how much water companies and other things can do or charge. And they have currently capped bill rises for water companies at 35% over the next 5 years, which is already quite a large amount. Thames Water have argued they want this to be 53%, and they have argued that this increase in bills is in the interest of our customers and the environment. As a customer of Thames Water, I am not necessarily sure if I agree that a bill rise is in the best intention of, you know, what I would like to do. But I'm again open to that debate. So Thames Water, hit me up and we will argue over whether or not I really do want to spend more money on my water. Just something to be aware of. Let's keep an eye on what the decision from Ofwat is. But I assume they're going to keep it as it is, seeing as there's a bunch of other large water companies in the country that are not going to be appealing against the 35%, because they're like, that's cool, that's enough. Anyway, stick around, because after this, we're going to have a bit of a one-on-one, me and you, about lifestyle creep.
FUPAR Radio. Politics Uncensored.
They can't turn off your water because water is a human right. It's not like internet, which we can talk about.
Are you saying we should all stop paying?
I'm not saying we should all stop paying. I think no one should have to pay.
Their argument would be prices are going up. We need all this money because we have to invest in our ageing Victoria infrastructure, which there's been no new infrastructure built in sewage, whatever, since the Victorian era. How would you respond to that?
They're talking out of their backside. It's bullshit of the highest order.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, is everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Mr. Later Williams, hello. Mate, can we just address that you did Strictly Come Dancing?
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair. But listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly. It won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got 2 hours, I was like, whoa, like there's so many different styles. I was like, oh. And Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
It got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23 and was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy. And as promised just before the break, I want to have a bit of a one-on-one with you about, we'll call it lifestyle creep. You might have heard it under various different guises. We've got lifestyle creep, lifestyle inflation, the concept of living within or below your means. Any of these, they all kind of mean the same thing, all right? But the reason why I want to have a bit of a one-on-one with you about it, because in my 4 or 5 years since I've started talking about money on the internet, and well before that, I do firmly believe that this concept is the single most important concept in the world of personal finance, full stop. Once you not only understand this, but start practicing this within your life on a consistent basis, you ultimately have hacked personal finance. You will be, I can pretty much say, you will be fine moving forward with your finances for the rest of your life. So for anyone that is watching live right now, do just drop like a thumbs up if you know the concept lifestyle inflation, lifestyle creep, live within your means, live below your means. If you've heard of it, if you understand it, if you practice it. If you don't practice it, thumbs down, because that will be the best way for me to straight away off the cuff understand kind of the gravity of how important this conversation needs to be and how the start I'm going to early I'm going to introduce the concept. But to be honest, it's probably worth starting for the beginning nonetheless. So let's do that exactly. This is the idea of looking at the difference between how much you bring in and how much you spend. So simple, right? So let's say you are earning £1,000. I know that's well below national minimum wage, but we're just going to use it as a relative guide. You're earning £1,000 and it costs £1,000 every single month for you to survive. You are currently at parity. You will never save a single penny, okay? Of course, if we can increase that gap, so eventually in life, you're going to hope to get a pay rise. Let's say maybe you get a 50% pay rise. Firstly, let me know how you've negotiated that, because that is bloody unbelievable. I could do with a 50% pay rise. I guess I would negotiate with myself, but that's fine. You go up from £1,000 to £1,500. Now, what happens in 99% of cases, and you'd be surprised, you're going to say, no, that would never happen to me. But this is what happens in 99% of cases. The amount that it costs you to live every single month goes up to £1,500 as well. So bringing in £1,500, it costs £1,500. In theory, you are getting no richer in life. Your life is on parity. You have brought up the cost of your living exactly in line with how much you are bringing in. Now, if you could literally reframe or take a step back from this entire concept and go, okay, I'm now earning £1,500, but I was completely fine earning £1,000. That is the science to hacking personal finance, because you now have a £500 buffer every single month, not to go and spend on X or Y or Z, but to put towards a future version of you, to do something clever with, to save for a house deposit, to put towards, you know, a big moment in your life. Maybe it's a car purchase, maybe it's a wedding, to put towards a future holiday or a honeymoon, to put towards your pension or to put towards your investments and savings, to put towards a financial goal beyond just living from month to month. Now, you would probably say to me, that's easy. If my the salary that I was earning went up by £500, there is no way that I would start spending an extra £500 a month. But if I told you right now that one in every three people in this country earning six figures and above, so that's £100,000 a year and above, is currently living from paycheck to paycheck, meaning every single pound and penny that they bring in every single month goes straight out that month and they rely on their next paycheck for them to survive, you wouldn't believe me, but that is the current statistics that we live in. So these are people earning six figures that are unable to practice this idea of avoiding lifestyle creep, avoiding lifestyle inflation, living within their means. So how are we going to do it? What's an actual practical way? Because I'm going to scrap actually what I said earlier, which was if you earn £1,500 and you can keep your cost of living at £1,000, that is world class. Because let's be realistic here, yeah? You're going to bring in some more money, you get that bonus, you get that raise. The odds of you maintaining your cost on a monthly basis at the exact level that it is right now, I would put down at a less than a 0.1% chance. Like, that psychologically is such a difficult thing to do. Like, you earn more, right? So you deserve the right to spend a little bit more. It's only human nature. And also, if you start earning more and more and more money, but you kind of punish yourself or you hold yourself back from ever spending more in your life, you'll start to kind of resent the whole world of personal finance, and it's never going to do anything good for you. You're going to think, well, great, all of this saving, but I'm never actually seeing or getting rewarded in real time on my current achievements. So, you know, the current version of you is doing super well, is getting bonuses, is getting pay rises, but the current version of you is never getting to enjoy it, to spend that money on the current version of you. It's always being put towards savings. And eventually that entire habit will break down and you'll lose this kind of motivation and momentum and discipline. The more realistic version of this is, let's say, let's go back to the scenario again. Your salary goes from £1,000 up to £1,500. You bring your spending from £1,000 a month to £1,100 a month. Maybe that means, I don't know, you get to have one or two more meals out with your friends every single month. Or I'm trying to think of some other things. You buy yourself a few nicer pieces of clothing for work. Or instead of that, you spend £300, a one-off celebration. You go to that beautiful restaurant you've always really wanted to go to somewhere in town. You go, you know, you dress up nice for the evening and you go and celebrate that achievement of earning more money, because earning more money is an achievement. It is a brilliant thing, a raise, a bonus. These are things to be celebrated. But that one-off payment of £300, let's say spread across, you know, like a 12-month period, is only going to be like, I don't know how good my math is, but like £25 a month, I think, or something like that. So your monthly increase in spending is tiny. You've done a one-off payment to reward yourself. Okay, it's significant. But then your spending or your lifestyle remains at exactly the same level. And this is what I mean by a realistic version of what I've been talking about. You celebrate it, you appreciate it, you let your lifestyle appreciate or inflate in whatever way you want to talk about it, just a tiny amount. But the gap between what you're bringing in and what you're spending has drastically increased. So it's gone from £0 to not the full 500 that you're bringing in every single month, but to 400, which is incredible. If you have the ability to do that, the discipline to do that, to celebrate or increase your lifestyle just a little bit, but nowhere near the percentage of what you've increased your income by, and you continuously do this every single time you start to bring in more money, I could literally, you could stop listening to this right now, because that is personal finance 101. It's one of the most difficult things to do, but it's why I consistently tell people that personal finance is such a simple topic, because that is all you need. Obviously, we can go into the complexities of what do you do with that gap, you know, that full £500 between what you're bringing in and what you're spending. Should it go on investing? Should it go on savings? Where should you keep it? How should you invest it? Where, like, is it a pension? All these kind of other various things. And those are the details that we can get into. But just having that ability to store excess of your income every single month is the key to personal finance. And it's one of the hardest things to do, but it's one of the most important things to do. And once you can do that, that's absolutely world class from you. So that is how it works. But what do most people do, and why is there such an issue, and why is it so difficult? Because I do need to kind of make you aware, I suppose, of the pitfalls. What could go wrong? So the obvious thing is, yeah, I'm trying to think of an example in my own life. When I was 18 and I went traveling and I was going away with mates, we would backpack, yeah? We would stay in the most dingy of places. Like, I could not care less. If it was horizontal, I could sleep. That was genuinely how I lived my life. obviously wasn't bringing in so much money at the age of 18. I was a student. If anything, I was going further and further into debt every single year because of that beautiful £9,250 I was spending on university. So income was zero, but my spending was relatively low. If we travelled, we did it on the cheap. I'm now, what, 10 years older than that, almost, for those that are trying to, like, fact check me. I'm 27. But if I go on holiday, I'm married. If we go with my wife, we're not probably going to stay in the most dingy of places in an 18-person dorm. If we go away on a holiday, we're probably going to have a slightly higher level of luxury. I'm not talking about, you know, the five-star Ritz-Carlton or anything like that. But we might look for a, you know, a private room that will cost a little bit more than, you know, the dingy hotel rooms I was sleeping in at the age of 18 because I just wanted to travel and do it as cheaply as possible. Now, that is a level of lifestyle inflation that has happened in my own life, right? Theoretically, it's also partly because I'm now earning money and I have the ability to do that, that I do that full stop. It's also the, I suppose, another key concept is I started earning more money and I decided I was ready to move out from home. So originally I had a zero cost on my rent. I was very fortunate. My parents were more than happy to accommodate me. And that shot up to, you know, just shy of £1,000 every single month. That is a huge jump in the amount that it cost for me to run my life. And it just went up because I was bringing in money. So therefore I had an excuse to spend more money. Lifestyle inflation is very, very normal and it's basically impossible to avoid. As you go through life, it just becomes more expensive. It's very likely that you're going to need to move out from home. Moving out from home means that you're going to need to start spending in bills. As you kind of climb the career ladder, you might need to start going into the office a bit more often, or you might need to start wearing slightly more presentable clothes from, you know, the joggers and a t-shirt that you wear when you work from home if you're climbing the career ladder. With your family, you know, you might need to start spending off if you have children. That's a huge element of lifestyle inflation. The average child, I believe, in this country costs something like £1,000 every single month, just per child that you're going to have. Now, these aren't kind of like avoidable lifestyle inflations. This is just what happens as you progress through life. Life just becomes more expensive. If it's just you, you know, relying on you being able to live at home versus you with a wife and three children, obviously that latter lifestyle is going to cost more. But hopefully you have the income to do it. But if throughout that entire process, as the costs of what you need to spend every single month increase and the amount that you hopefully earn starts to increase and increase, just try and keep that gap growing and growing and growing. You get a bonus once a year or twice a year. Try and put as much of it away to future you and use a little bit to celebrate and enjoy. If you get a pay rise, try and think to yourself, how much of this pay rise can I realistically start putting away every single month? If it's £200 a month and you just put an extra £10 of that £200 towards future you, that is personal finance 101. You're doing the right thing. That gap between what you're bringing in and what you're spending is slowly starting to increase and increase and increase. So that's lifestyle inflation. I could talk for days on this, but I've essentially just given you the crux, the gold, you know, the diamond about personal finance, and everything aside from that is just noise. It's just extra information to kind of get that, you know, 1%, 5%, 10% better. So yeah, there are so many easy ways. And I suppose another thing to kind of keep in mind are, like, what are the big expenses in your life right now? Because potentially you might be living well above your means at this point in life, a life of luxury, and it might be time for you to start reducing the level of your lifestyle, because it's at an unaffordable rate right now that if you don't bring it down at this point, you know, you kind of have screwed over yourself for the next 5, 10, 15 years. So is it time to think about the place that you're living? Are you living in central London, you know, on your own, when theoretically you're not going to be able to afford that for a very long time? So you might want to start moving out the moment your lease is up. Can you renegotiate your car insurance and do something like that? There are so many different ways to kind of try and combat this and move around this. But yeah, I'm going to keep saying it, like, again and again and again. If I could get one tattoo plastered across my forehead to walk around London with, it would just say the words, live within your means. Yeah. Try and increase the gap between what you're bringing in and what is going out. Try and identify it early. Try and write down right now every single source of income you have and all of your average monthly expenditures. Work it out now. Because if you keep ignoring it and assuming that you have that gap there, I promise you that gap will not exist. You have to be conscious. You have to take actual practical steps. You actually have to get a piece of pen and paper or get on Excel and start opening up the bank accounts and start opening up the credit cards right now to understand the current point you are at this stage in your life and start to work out how you are going to increase that gap moving forward. Like I said, your lifestyle will inflate. It is inevitable. To keep that gap growing and growing and never increase the amount that it costs you on a monthly basis to live is pretty much impossible. If you can do it, drop me a DM, drop the show a DM at That Money Show. let us know how you do it, because I want that gold from you if you've been able to do that. But it's going to go up. So can you continuously increase that gap every single month? Because if you can, that is the key. That is how to win at personal finance. And everything else I say, I mean, you can start building it off the back of that. I'm going to end with this, because this is like a nice little kind of something you can write down in a few notes, which is, I always say personal finance theoretically can be distilled down into four steps. And if you kind of cover these four steps theoretically, you don't really need to know anything else. And I've said that lifestyle inflation is the only thing you need to need, but I'm going to add a few more steps to it. Step one is get rid of all high interest debt. Get rid of it. Credit card debt, loans, you know, payday loans, whatever they are, Klarna, get rid of high interest debt and do it as quickly and as aggressively as possible. Live as frugally as you can and get rid of those things, because that is what holds you back with your finances. Number two is build yourself a buffer, an emergency fund. It is so important, because unexpected financial circumstances happen. They do. It's just a fact of life. Your car will break down eventually and you're going to have to cover it. You will pop a tire, okay? Get that buffer, build it up now, and have that. It's not the most mathematically pure thing to do with your money, but psychologically, it's going to absolutely improve the way that your brain works around money, and you are going to have money confidence you have never had before. Number three is learn to save and invest early and often. That is kind of, you know, the crux of it. Put money towards a future version of you. That's the whole point of personal finance. And number four, understand lifestyle inflation, live within your means, because that will absolutely rapidly accelerate the rates at which you can do steps one, two, and three. Yeah? The quicker you can do one, two, and three, the quicker you can achieve all of the financial goals that you have in life. And that is a drop the mic moment on lifestyle inflation. I hope that I've convinced you. If I haven't, this might not be the show for you, but I hope that I have for 99.9% of you. And on that note, this is the start of the show where I give you money tip of the week. And you would probably assume, have you not just given me money tip of the week for the past 15 minutes telling me about lifestyle inflation? But I'm going to add, you know, a little, I like to give something, you know, a little bit more interesting and throw another bit of spice into the show. And this week, I'm going to be talking about everyone's favorite type of saving account, premium bonds. You heard of premium bonds? No? Okay, I'll give you a quick 1-2 on premium bonds, okay? They're like a saving product. I think they're kind of supplied by the government, fairly certain. But it's a bit like a lottery. You put your money in. You don't spend it, actually, so you can pull out the money that you've put in as well. You can put in up to £50,000. I think you have to put in at least £50. And like every £50 or £25 that you put in is like adding another lottery ticket. And they do a prize draw every month. A couple of people win £1 million. A couple of people win £100,000. A few more win £50,000. On average, I think right now, it's a 4% return, the prizes that they give out. So do I like them? Are they actually any good as a savings product? My answer is this. If you only have your money in premium bonds, it's probably not the best move. I have premium bonds, but I do not only have premium bonds. They are a lottery style system. There is a good chance, by the way, that you will never win a single prize and you'll be stuck with the money that you have in the bank, which is reducing every single month thanks to inflation. The reason why I still have premium bonds despite having that opinion is because I also invest, I have a pension, I have saving accounts, fixed rate savings accounts, I have an emergency fund, and I have some premium bonds. So what you can hear there is I diversify. I have my money across all five things. So my controversial take is that premium bonds are a waste of money if you don't have money anywhere else, because if you don't win anything, you are literally just sitting on cash that is most likely not going to win a prize and is going to be reduced by inflation. It's like just playing the lottery as your style of savings, but without actually having to give away the money that you put under the mattress in the first place. In my humble opinion, again, this is not financial advice. I'm not telling you what to do, but diversification has always been the key word with anyone in the world of personal finance. It's just me. Anyway, stick around, guys, because up next, I'm going to be joined by Norma Cassius at think.like.a.bank. They're a money management consultant, counselor, and psychotherapist to talk about the red flags that could lead to financial manipulation in relationships.
FUPAR Radio. Politics Uncensored.
They can't turn off your water because water is a human right. It's not like internet, which we can talk about.
Are you saying we should all stop paying?
I'm not saying we should all stop paying. I think no one should have to pay.
Their argument would be prices are going up. We need all this money because we have to invest in our aging Victoria infrastructure, which there's been no new infrastructure built in sewage, whatever, since the Victorian era. How would you respond to that?
They're talking out of their backside. It's bullshit of the highest order.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen plenty of favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Mr. Later Williams, hello. Mate, can we just address that? You did Strictly Come Dancing.
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair. But listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly. Won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got to it, I was like, whoa, like there's so many different styles. I was like, oh. And Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
It got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23 and was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
Making personal finance simpler with Gabriel Nussbaum. This is That Money Show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show, live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy. And as I said earlier, we're about to have a very deep discussion on the idea about financial manipulation within relationships. So I think this is a step further than what I was actually teasing at the start of the show, which is the idea of, you know, like, just, I suppose, finance in relationships, full stop. You know, I put out the claim of who pays on the first date. That is like a classic topic that people think of, that people hear when it comes to the world of finance and relationships. But what I want to talk to you guys about today, and I'm actually joined by Norma Cassius from think.like.a.bank. Norma is a money management consultant, a counsellor, and a psychotherapist. And she's going to help me understand the idea of financial manipulation, how you can spot it, how you can address it, because this is a really important topic. So stick around, and we're going to have quite a few questions. Anyway, Norma, welcome to That Money Show. How are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you. And how are you?
I'm doing really well. And I'm really interested to dive into this discussion here, because financial manipulation isn't a topic often, I suppose, discussed out in public. It's quite a sensitive one when it does happen. And when it does happen, people aren't often aware that it's happening. And when they are aware, it's not really something they would like to share publicly. So can you start by explaining what financial manipulation within a relationship is, and what are some common examples that people can look out for?
Right, okay, sure. So financial manipulation, that obviously is quite broad. But just looking at some basic things, for example, if your partner was to buy something for you, and, you know, then you decided to an outfit, and you decided to go out with your friends on the weekend with that outfit, and then they didn't speak to you for like a couple of days, a few days, because you've gone out and wore their outfit, that is financial manipulation. You know, and it's so subtle that, you know, a lot of people don't realise this is what's going on. Another example is if like you're coerced into taking out a loan, you're in love and you know you want to get a car, or your partner wants to get a car, and it's like you're so in love that you don't mind doing anything for them, and you take out a loan in your name, and then further down the line, you know, you break up, you've still got that debt. Things like that. Do you know what I mean? Being manipulated. Sometimes people are in domestic violence relationships where they're manipulated and coerced into taking out debts or credit cards, buying their other partner clothes. One of the big things that happens a lot in relationships is when people are in relationships and one person takes control of the finances, just also almost making their partner feel it's okay, I've got this. And so they're paying all the bills and everything. And then if, you know, when that partner asks about any area of their finances, they don't want to share it. They want to be in total control of the money. And then I've had classic cases where that's been the case and then the relationship is broken down and that partner doesn't have a clue of, you know, where to start. How to pay their mortgage or how to pay bills, shop, you know, how to, you know, manage their money. And emotionally, psychologically, it's very, very problematic because obviously the anxiety, the stress, the depression, feeling overwhelmed and hopeless, all these emotions come into play.
Yeah, those are some really, I suppose, scary and worrying examples, but I suppose those are the examples of what financial manipulation are. So I think off the back of that, I would love to kind of understand where the line is between, I suppose, healthy financial management within a partnership versus financial manipulation. One of the examples that you just spoke about is the idea of, you know, one person within a relationship taking more responsibility of the finances, which is actually often the case in a lot of relationships. You know,
absolutely.
Relationships are about, you know, balance. You do one thing, they do the other, something else. You both play to your strengths. So that's quite often a common. I think even in my own relationship, I would, be lying to say that, like, I speak about money all the time, so I take a much keener interest in making sure, you know, we've got the best saving rates and all this kind of stuff. But there has to be, I suppose, a very clear line between where you're sharing that information and it's publicly, like you said, publicly available. Like, if they once they want to be interested in it, they should always have the ability to know where everything is, versus financial manipulation. So how do they differ and where is the line between the two?
I think the red flag is when they don't want to share it. It's like you're asking for that information and they're saying, no, it's okay, don't worry about it, I've got this sorted. Do you know what I mean? I think having a healthy relationship with your finances is setting a time once a month for you to sit down and talk about, you know, subscriptions are coming up or energy bills or contracts are coming up. You know, let's talk about how we can, you know, how we go forward with this. Do we look to see if we can, you know, get a better provider or, you know, what can we do better with our finances? I think it's something that needs to be communicated regularly on a monthly basis, because as we know, unexpected events can happen at any time, which can change the trajectory of your finances. Now, if you're not discussing that at any point, just to, you know, shock somebody with, you know, and sometimes things happen. I mean, I talk about financial infidelity and that's for another day, but you know, people are taking out loans, they're in relationships, their partner has no idea. Do you know what I mean? And that affects, if you're working together, you know, saving for a mortgage or whatever, that really does affect your spending power. So communication as often as possible. You agree on a day or a day each month that you're going to come together and discuss your finances is the way forward.
Absolutely. So if someone is listening to this and they're not sure whether they're being financially manipulated or not, because I suppose even though the scenarios you're describing sound quite obvious, right? The idea of you ask your partner, oh, where, like, how much did we spend last month? And they're like, I'm not going to tell you. Or they have full eyesight of that. To us, that sounds really clear and obvious. But to the person actually experiencing it, they might just be like, oh, okay. Like, and they'll move on with their life. So how, what should someone be aware of to know that they are being financially manipulated? Because, like I said, it can't be that clear. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any scenarios of it.
Absolutely. I guess it's just, you know, persisting. If they say, no, that's okay, I mean, you know, for you, it's them for the partner to say, I know it's okay, but I really would like to know. I'd like to see the figures. I would really like to know, have a clear picture of what our finances look like. It's about being insisting that you have that insight, you have that knowledge. I mean, even if it's only once, if that person doesn't, is really insisting that they don't want to give it to you, then that really is a red flag, because there shouldn't be any reason why it's not available to you.
Are there any kind of like big punishments when financial manipulation does come out, I suppose, within the courts? Because this is a legal argument, right? And like, because the moment finances become involved and, you know, it comes out, a couple breaks up and they realize they've been manipulated this whole time. Like, what are some of these financial or legal implications and ramifications?
Right. So in terms of like legal consequences, I mean, a lot of the times people's credit score has been affected. Do you know what I mean? It's, you know, they can't get the any financial products that they would like to because of, you know, the situation. And so you know, a person's really restricted their finances, and that can go on for decades if they're not able to turn it around. And so, you know, these are some of the things they need to explain, that, you know, I really need to know what's going on with our finances, you know. And and also add that they could also add to, you know, their financial situation. They could bring value to their financial situation. So it's so important. I mean, especially, I think it's the most important thing is their credit, and it is making sure their credit is in good shape. So it's so important for them to understand that, you know, they need to be on top of what's going on with their finances, so they can obviously have their finances in the best possible shape.
I've got quite a specific scenario in my head that I would love to kind of, you know, play around with you and understand how this would work out. So in some relationships, you have someone that is the only earner in the household, and it's not that uncommon. I think it's becoming more and more uncommon these days, as, you know, you do normally need two incomes to support a lifestyle in the current climate and economy. But there are scenarios where, you know, you might have one person who is earning extremely well that allows the other person in the relationship to not have to work. Maybe they can, you know, they have that ability to be a bit more luxurious. They'll look after the household a bit more. Maybe they'll be the, you know, in charge of childcare, etc. Or maybe they'll literally just have that luxury where they don't have to work because their partner has the full, is the, like, fully the breadwinner in the family. How can you manage having that situation without financial manipulation? So what are some healthy or ways that someone can orientate that kind of dynamic? Because it sounds really difficult, right? Imagine that, you know, you're the one that's providing all of the money and your partner is simply spending it, and you aren't comfortable with the amount they're spending, and you'll always feel like, you know, I'm the one earning that, like, what's going on here? So how do you arrange that situation?
Okay, so I mean, obviously, if somebody's fortunate to be in that situation, again, it's having that conversation. Because, all right, you're the breadwinner, but how much are you comfortably okay with, you know, giving that person an allowance? It has to be a mutual agreement, because there's no point, you know, saying you don't need to work, I'll take care of you, mm-hmm. but resenting the fact that they're spending all your money. Do you know what I mean? And then, you know, you don't feel that it's being valued in such a way. So again, it's about, really importantly, communication. Communicating, look, this is how much, you know, they can, you know, the other part that's not working saying, could say that this is how much I would like. And then the other, you know, the partner that's supplying the money, agreeing to a certain figure, mutual agreement. Because with mutual agreement, if you're agreeing to give them £1,000 or £1,500 a month, then, and you're happy for them to do whatever they want to do with that money, then there shouldn't be an issue. The issue is if they're telling you what they need, the person that's not working, and you're reluctantly giving it to them because obviously you feel that you want to please them, then obviously that's going to cause a problem.
Yeah, definitely. Just one last one then is, if someone does believe they're being financially manipulated, what can they do? Where can they go to help and get some support?
Okay, so I'm an ambassador for survivors of economic abuse. And if you just look it up, SEA, just Google SEA, survivors of economic abuse, they will be able to support you all the way. You don't have to suffer alone, or you don't have to suffer in silence. They have so much resources for people that are experiencing economic abuse. And, you know, they're very, very, very helpful for everybody that's in that situation.
Amazing.
So you're not alone. That is the key takeaway. You're not alone. There's so much help out there, especially from survivors of economic abuse.
Thank you, Norma. Really appreciate your time. And I hope that people do look into this if that's something necessary to them.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. I know it's quite a deep conversation, that, about financial manipulation. But this is That Money Show, and we will always cover every single aspect of it, from some of the more playful concepts to definitely some of the more serious ones like financial manipulation. So SEA, for those of you that are thinking this is something that you're experiencing, please do look into it. Or if there's someone you know that could do with contacting that organisation, please do. Now, it is time for the audience questions. Every single week, we ask you, if you're watching live, to ask me a question right now to be answered live on radio, or to DM us at That Money Show. That's our handle on Instagram, at That Money Show. Nice and easy. Send us your questions and we will try and answer as many of them as we can every single week. And I'm going to kick off with Tom, who's come in straight away and has asked, is there a right way to save money? I currently just have a bog standard savings account with my bank with 3.25% interest. So my answer to this is, you should have no loyalty in the world of finance, like zero loyalty whatsoever. Just because you bank with them doesn't mean you need to have any other product with them. In fact, if you don't even like banking with them, you should go around and try and move around, because there are services called like the current account switch service. We make it really easy for you to be with the optimal provider that you want to be with. Right now, you should be able to find saving accounts with interests of over 4%. Depends on the time that you're listening to this show. So 3.25%, you are already under, I suppose, the best interest rates in the market. So is there a right way to save money? If you're just simply looking for the best interest rate, go on Google, type in best interest rate, or best saving accounts, or best cash ISA, or best 1-year fixed saving account, depending on what kind of account you want. And I'll go through them in a second. But ultimately, find the best one that you are comfortable using. It should be FCA regulated and FSCS protected. Those are two things you always want to look out for with any financial institution that you are storing your money within. And then just try and you get the best bang for your buck. So that is definitely the right way. In terms of the saving account options that I told you before, you've got easy access. You know, you can get your money at any single point. You can lock your money away for a year and sometimes get different types of interest rates. So 1 year, 2 year, 5 years, et cetera, et cetera. You can have notice accounts, where you have to give them notice if you want to withdraw your money. Someone actually told me that that's a brilliant way if you're really bad and you keep pulling money out of your savings. Get a notice bank account, because that takes 30 days for them to send you the money after you tell them that you want them, or 60 days or 90 days, whatever it is. And it's a great way for you to be a little bit more disciplined. You can save in premium bonds, which I spoke about earlier in the show. Just understand what they are and what they do. So the right way to invest is just making sure that your money is working as hard for you as possible, and you have got it in the, like, I suppose, best style account that will allow you to save in the best way possible. The other types, I suppose, of savings, or the right way to save money, is think about what the goal is. If it's a short-term goal, you want it secure and getting a good interest rate. If it's a long-term goal, and I'm talking 5-10 years plus, well, that money is for, and you are 100% confident you are not going to need that money, that is where some people start to talk or turn towards investing. And I'm not going to dive into that world right now. I'm just going to kind of leave that one on a cliff edge for now. So Jenny has asked me, I've just gained a significant amount of money and property after the death of my granddad. Is there anything that is exempt from inheritance tax? So let's start with your inheritance tax thresholds. This is from the entire estate passed down. So it's not just what you are exempt from, it's from anyone receiving the inheritance from your granddad. So the first £325,000 that he passes on through inheritance is exempt from inheritance tax. Now, if he has an estate, I believe worth under 2 mil, that means like a property or a few properties, that allowance goes up to £500,000. If it includes, for example, he inherited all of the money from his partner, if they are no longer alive as well, or his wife or whatever it is, the allowance, kind of, you get both of their allowances rolled into one. So that would be 650 without a property, or 1 mil with a property, again, depending on the value of the property. So that's kind of the original things that are exempt from inheritance tax. And then at the moment, I'm fairly certain, and please do always do your own research on this, that pensions are currently not part of your inheritance allowance. So they fall outside of it. Pensions get passed on tax-free. This is changing in April 2027. The rules are going to come in to make pensions now part of your estate when it comes to inheritance. But right now, they are not. So those are the key things that you'll want to be aware of. And the other question is, I'm going to take one from someone that's watching live right now. Someone's just said, should I drip feed or lump sum dump my money into the S&P 500. I can't tell you what to do or how to invest. All I can simply say is that, I don't know, I'm trying to think. I can't really give you advice. I can't tell you what to invest in or how to invest. So that kind of question is down to your own research. Do your own research. Pick away. It sounds brilliant that you're investing in the first place and you're aware of how to invest and you kind of are aware of what you want to invest in as well. But the difference between the two, there's some research on the two, which one has given better returns over the past decade, whether, you know, putting it in right at the beginning or dripping it over a long time, which is kind of dollar cost averaging, which is a tactic that I really love. So all I'm going to say to you is this isn't the question that you should be taking anyone's advice from except for your own research. Anyway, that's all we've got time for on the show. So I do want to say thank you to all of you for listening. I want to thank Norma also for coming on and discussing financial manipulation. If you want to listen to us live, you can download the FUBAR Radio app or watch on all social media platforms. You can find us at That Money Show on all podcasting platforms. Send us your questions on Instagram at That Money Show. I've been That Money Guy. And you are now officially better with your money. See you next week.
FUBAR Radio.